Welcome to the Sonic Nuance Electronics Podcast, focusing on topics of interest to worship teams as well as anyone involved with musical recording and performance.
Today's interview is with Mark Averill, worship pastor at Westgate Church in San Jose, California. Mark, I read your bio on the Westgate website. Can you talk about how many instruments you can play and what they are?
I start off as a keyboard player, and I learned the trumpet, played that for a handful of years, and then learned drums for a little bit. And my mom was a choral director, so I actually did a lot of choral music stuff back in the day, and I was actually a vocal major in college. And then about the last 15 years, I've been playing the guitar.
Wow. What instruments do you usually lead with as a worship leader?
I find for me the best instrument is the acoustic or the guitar, electric acoustic, but I do lead on occasion from the piano.
And why is that you find it easier compared to the piano, for example?
It's a little bit smaller of a piece of furniture. And so you can kind of move around a little bit more with the guitar. I can walk in different places on stage. For a smaller venue, it just feels a little bit more intimate. So I just I'm a stronger keyboard player. So on the guitar, I just have a lot less options, and so I get less distracted and can just worship on the guitar.
Oh, play a lot more simply, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. So with that in mind, you're normally playing acoustic guitar. What instruments do you usually have as a configuration for service?
Yes. We usually run one keyboard player, two background vocals, bass, drums, electric guitar, and then I'm either on acoustic or I play electric. So and then we run stems and stuff like that as well, but that's usually our bread and butter.
Can you describe for me a process of choosing a set list? How do you choose the songs?
We have kind of a style guide that we go off of that kind of just helps us. We usually are shooting for about five songs, and we have a process where the worship leaders sit in and on a content meeting where our teachers talk about what they're going to be teaching on, and from that we kind of you ask the question, what are people going to need and what will they need next, and so we kind of go through a grid of something that's an opening call to worship, followed by something that focuses on the nature and character and actions of God, followed by something that's more intimate, and that's generally a flow that we take a lot, kind of a come into his gates with thanksgiving, come into his courts with praise, and then come into the Holy of Holies. So it kind of has a progress. So we choose songs that are based off of that. And we're not, coming out of the teaching, a lot of times the question is, what do people need next? So we choose songs that kind of address that issue. So if the teacher's saying something that feels like people need to conclude with a celebratory moment, then it's a song that's that way. If they need reflection, or something that's contemplative, we'll follow up with a song that serves that purpose. If we're doing communion at the following, we may do songs that kind of are directed around that idea. Our question is, where are we going for the morning or for the evening? And then what serves that purpose the best?
Got it. So it's pretty tied in with the message, is what you're saying, regardless what the message is.
It is. A lot of times because we don't always know. Sometimes the teachers change things or what they say they're going to focus on is something they say, but not necessarily something they focus on. So a lot of times we choose sets that are a basic kind of progression of worship, just what you see in Psalms 95, where you call to worship, something that, again, celebrates God and then maybe is something more intimate with God. So that is a lot of times a direction that we go. But the big question is, what's the one focus for that worship gathering? And we try to serve that with, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we choose only songs like on deliverance or songs on, peace or whatever,
Sure.
It doesn't mean we just just choose that.
You're also looking for songs to set a mood, for example, like people walking in, getting them energized, for example. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
You know, we're trying to find a way to help people easily latch on to what to a connection with God, to experience God. So we're always looking for on-ramps that make it easy for people. So the music we play when people come in the building hopefully serves that. You know, the opening song. I don't expect a person usually coming into our building having had high engagement with God already. You know, usually they've just come from collecting their kids and getting them settled in Kidstown and then getting their coffee, parking, you know, all that stuff. So they usually, it takes them a little bit of time to kind of shed those kind of concerns and thoughts and stuff. Yeah. So, you know, we usually try to help make it easy for them to kind of start the process by something that's easy to latch on with.
That makes sense. How do you introduce new songs to the congregation?
Yeah, we're actually teaching a new one this weekend. We do one a month, and usually it's not like we'll sing just the chorus of it. If there's something tricky, there's been a few songs where I taught just the chorus, and then we lent into the song, but usually we just sing it, and then we do it two weekends in a row, figuring that the average person in our church probably doesn't come every single weekend, so I want to catch the largest cross-section of our people when we teach a new song and make sure they've got it. So that helps by doing it two weekends in a row. So that's usually our process. We make, for the musicians, we teach it by, we make tutorials a lot of times. I usually do a keys tutorial. We usually have vocal parts for the singers. I usually go in and record my vocals and then record an alto and a tenor so that the singers can learn their songs, and then that sits in Planning Center so people can, you know, learn their parts and everybody can come the most prepared.
I see. And what did you mean by keys tutorial? You mean just playing the keyboards along with the progression of the song?
Yeah, keyboard tutorial and sometimes electric guitar tutorial. Those are the ones that, you know, bass and drums can kind of get their parts from the recording, but a lot of times we're changing the keys from the original, so, you know, that changes where the guitar player is on the fretboard or the keyboard, you know, changes. So if you take sometimes their parts and play them down two or three steps, they may be too muddy, so we try to reimagine what that's going to be like in the keys that we think works best for the congregation. So a keyboard tutorial where I just say, okay, here are the different zones that we've got different sounds on for this song. You know, a lot of times we zone out the keyboard where there's like bell parts up high or certain piano parts that are just, you know, for certain parts of the song. And then, you know, so we just kind of walk them through so they can just come in and know how the keyboard's set up for that song. And it makes it easy for a keyboard player just to play for us.
I see. And are there vocal cues on those tutorials normally? Like, here's chorus one, chorus two, verse one, verse two.
You know, it's funny. I got some of our worship leaders, one in particular really likes that. I find them kind of annoying, and I'm always telling him when he puts him in the stem to just either not put him in or put him so soft that I don't find them helpful. Usually I can memorize the roadmap, so I don't need the cues, and we stay pretty much on top of the metronome on them, so it doesn't feel like I need that to reinforce. So, yeah, I just haven't found it helpful. But some guys like them, and that's legit. That's cool.
You mentioned metronome, so you guys are normally playing with a click track?
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, we've been doing that a lot over here as well.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the importance of singable songs, if that makes any sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's, we're doing them so our people can worship, not so that we can perform them. So they've got to be songs. A couple things I look at when I'm choosing songs is the rhythm of them so difficult that it's not, like, not to call out David Crowder, but I've often felt like back in the day, sometimes his songs, man, we had to teach them over and over before our congregation really got them because they were either somewhat non-symmetrical in the rhythmic patterns of them, that they were hard. You had to hear them so many times before you really got it. So you got to ask that question, you know, is it just such a difficult rhythm that the average singer just can't listen, you know, can't catch it real quick. So that's one idea. The other idea is vocal range, you know. A lot of the worship songs come from very good performing artists. you know, Chris Tomlin being, you know, one of them who have really extreme wide performing professional ranges where the average congregation person doesn't have a professional range. So we do that for them, not to serve, you know, so that we can sing songs we really like. So I always feel like, you know, some conventional wisdom has said, you know, choose it. The average human voice can sing a C between middle, between C and C, that one octave range. So that's kind of helpful to know. And so putting songs there, but I do think you got to ask who, the worship leader, what's his or her vocal range? It's got to sit pretty good for them, and hope that you'll serve some of your congregation good, but others will be less good. I feel like when you use a, when you put the song in a, maybe this is too much information than you want, but
no,
if
that's
you,
right.
If you put the song in a good range for an alto, say just a medium or a mezzo soprano or a medium vocal range for a female singer, what it's going to do is it's going to be for a high tenor, they can sing it in unison with them. But for a guy, a low, a bass, it's going to put them in the basement. So when I've heard female worship leaders lead, I usually hear in the crowd strong female presence that I can hear the female voice the most. When you usually use a baritone and you choose the range that's good for them, the guys can really latch on and sing. And then the women kind of sing down a little bit lower. But I always feel like worship congregational singing suits a woman a little bit better because maybe they're a little bit less inhibited to sing. Guys, so I want to put it in a great range for a guy, I guess is my point. You know, I think a tenth, so a little bit more than an octave, is probably the ceiling on what you can ask the average singer to do, or the average you know, person to sing. A lot of the worship songs right now run the melody between one and five, and then they kick it up a full octave. That's just, I think it's really hard to do on the congregation. We've done, like, One Thing Remains kind of does that, where it starts the song low, and then it kicks up, the entire melody kicks up an entire octave. So what we've done is we've dropped the key down so that we don't do the full octave sweep. We just sing the entire song in that one through five note range. And it loses something. It definitely does. I mean, it's cool when you start down in the basement and then the band kicks in and you fully kick on. I just don't think the average person can do that with you. And so, again, to me, I want them singing. We're there to make their voice strong.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You're not there to do a performance. You're there to serve the message and serve the congregation, I guess.
Absolutely.
You kind of touched on this, but do you do reflective songs when either with no lyrics or lyrics that aren't meant to be sung along to? For example, something that's really too complex for the congregation, so you just ask them to listen?
Yeah, we call them feature songs. So, like, yeah, we don't do them a ton, only because you really, if they're a feature song, they've got to really fit with either where a teaching is going to go or some kind of moment in the worship service really fits with that. That's so unique that it would be kind of a performing song that the congregation could be edified by and built up from, but we're not asking them to participate with us. So we have done those on occasion. A lot of times they have a higher maybe, for lack of a better word, kind of performance capacity to them, so that usually a dance goes with them, or we've done stuff where we have full video that we've done where the band plays to a click that's coming from the video and everything's, you know, wedded together, the visual image with the vocal performance with the band, and it's usually, a lot of times there'll be secular pieces that maybe they're on the radio and they serve kind of a teaching directive, and so they have a functional purpose. But we also do stuff that are just solely instrumental, like coming out of a teaching time, we may have some reflective listening where we just ask a few questions on the screen and have people sit in quiet. But we found that if it's actually dead silence, it actually becomes more distracting because then people are listening to coughs and sniffs and people moving their purses. So having a little bit of instrumental music that's simple, that's non, you know, it doesn't have a lot of stuff going on to it, can really serve a quiet moment and that it would allow people to reflect and to think and maybe even have prayer and things like that. So we've done feature pieces that are, like I said, performing, more performing based, that teach maybe in themselves or ask a real penetrating question that would help where the teaching may go. Or we've done, yeah, just instrumental pieces that are reflective and quiet and contemplative.
Yeah, we've at our church, we've done very similar things. You mentioned quiet time. Oftentimes we have a prayer time, and we've found that if it was dead silent, then people wouldn't ask for prayers because you could actually hear what they're asking for.
Right.
So
right.
We ended up always playing something during that time.
I think it helps. It just it creates just kind of a low grade noise that helps people engage, but doesn't draw that they don't feel really conscientious or self-conscious when that's there. So it kind of serves them well.
What is your approach regarding remaining faithful to a recordings arrangement versus taking artistic license?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I totally respect, and we used to, back in the day, we would take a song and rearrange it, and we'd do it for for the first couple of years, we would do it the way it's written, and then we would reimagine it, and that's super fun to do. In our world, we don't have a midweek rehearsal, so it's you almost have to have time to experiment and try things, and then you have to record it so the band can learn it that exact way. And we have just stayed true to the recordings. One of the things that I find that is nice about that is the players all know coming in. A keyboard player comes in knowing the electric guitar is going to play that certain lick, and I'm just doubling it. Or if I don't play it, he'll have it. So everybody kind of knows what the other person is doing, so nobody's stepping on each other's toes. The bass player knows exactly what the kick part is going to be for the drummer, because we follow to the musical directors and worship leaders make the band follow those performances. It's fine. It's just another way to do it. It's just, for us, we don't reimagine the songs, and we've lost a little something in that. It's just kind of fun to be creative with it. We found that when you don't have a midweek rehearsal and don't have the time to experiment and to go, oh, you know what, when you do that, that kills what the electric player is doing, so let's rework it. We just don't have time for that. So we just take the recordings as they are, put them in the keys that work good for our worship leaders and feel it is good for our congregation, and then just do them right off the recordings like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Having an extra practice time would definitely allow you to try things like that.
Yeah, I like doing it. I mean, it's great for the musicians to be creative with it and that kind of thing. We also, though, and also it keeps the song fresh. If you've done it for a certain way for a number of years, our only thing is we have a 40-song playlist. So in about 3 years, a song that was really hot gets taken off and new songs get put on every month.
I see. Let's say a song has an instrumental solo on it, like a guitar solo or whatnot. What's your stance on that? Like, do it note for note, let some improvisation come in, change the tone. What's your approach?
Yeah, I mean, what we've done is we just learn it lick for lick, line, note for note. Again, that way everybody's really secure with what's going on. We all know what to expect. I do have some really good players who know how to improvise in a way that's serves the song. One of the dangers, I think, in my past experience is if you don't do what's on the recording, an older player, maybe an Eddie Van Halen guy, and thinks, you know, hey, this is my moment to let this stuff go and you know, play something that just tears it up. But I'm like, yeah, that's what, nobody plays that anymore. It doesn't fit the style of the song. And mm-hmm. It's more distracting to the congregation. Everybody's watching you, so it doesn't really serve us connecting with God. At the same time, I'm for us celebrating, God's gift to people who are virtuosos. So, I think that there's a place probably for that. We usually just do the songs note for note. If I do, like, sometimes we do a band jam, something at the front end. We'll usually cover some secular song while people come in the building sometimes. And then, or we'll just do some little groove song, and I'll give the players opportunity. I have some guys who can just do great at that and know appropriate things to play. And so we'll do it, let them have a moment just to kind of have fun with the song, and people dig it when they come in. But I also, it's just hard because, you know, if you give one guy a solo and he doesn't, you know, I've had guys who are like blues players and we're playing songs. I'm like, this is not a blues song. I know that's what you play, but when I give you 8 bars to solo over, that's not what the style of song is. It's not a blues song or a jazz. They're wanting to do all these, you know, modal things. I'm like, yeah, that isn't the style of the song. So I find it more helpful for us just to say, this is the solo they have on there. Usually they're not virtuosic, so they're just simple lines that you hear on Bethel or Jesus Culture stuff. And, it's just everybody knows what's going on. The crowd kind of has heard it now a number of times, so they're not distracted by it. And we usually try to put slides up that maybe are prompts to think about something or to prayer prompts so that they're engaged even when we have an instrumental section or part of the song.
Oh, interesting. During a solo, you might have a message up there.
Yeah, like even we'll have a scripture passage or a prompt to, you know, if the song's talking about faith and just say, hey, you know, ask God to give you more faith, or, you know, something like that. Or I've had like Lady Gaga quotes up there, something, anything that just kind of serves people engaging, you know, that kind of speaks to what the song's about and keeps people engaged so they're not tempted to just like lose the focus with us. So if they're long, you know, 32 bar solo, so somebody could get really distracted by that or just disengaged.
Sure.
So something like that is helpful, I think.
What's your approach to motivating the volunteers? Assuming you have volunteers, I should have asked that. So what's your approach to motivating the musicians to practice?
Well, for us, if you haven't woodshedded a good couple hours or, you know, spent a good amount of time without a midweek rehearsal, that's one of the things I tell them is our system is set up so I expect you to come prepared on Saturday night or Sunday morning to play these songs. We have gotten rid of a midweek requirement for you so that now you can just do your own work and prepare. So if a guy comes in and he doesn't know his stuff, they usually haven't lasted for us. This is not the right service or the right ministry for them then, because I just expect them to come in and know their parts. You know, it's more of a sound check for us than it is a rehearsal. Yeah, it just is kind of inherent in our system. On my end, I try to give them everything that they know exactly what parts they need to learn. So we usually post our sets a good 10 days before we do them. And then the week of, I usually send band notes like, hey, there's, you know, electric player, don't forget you got this little intro part that's a specific lick. And keyboard player, you know, there's this little bridge part that you play. And so they kind of know what to listen for. And then my expectation is they go into Planning Center, download the keyboard tutorial, kind of make notes as far as, oh, that's right, the keyboard's zoned in this way, and these are the parts I need to work on. If there's anything technical, I'll sit at an acoustic piano and work it out. And so that they come in having spent time with the songs. And on occasion I'll get somebody who, you know, says, hey, man, I had a busy week. And I'm like, dude, I love you, but call me if that happens. I'll get a sub for you, because you just can't come in and not know this stuff. It doesn't serve our people well when you do that. And the rest of the band feels they all invested their time. It doesn't feel fair for them to have to wait while I go over to the keyboard, Rick, and show you what to play. So I just expect them to practice it. And I do too. I mean, I never come in not having spent time with the song. So I'm like, if I do it, and I think I can ask you to do it.
What do you find is a common mistake with instrumental performers making? And that's probably geared more towards somebody new coming in.
Ask me the question. Just ask it again. I mean, what is it that you're kind of wanting to know? Like, for instance,
I'm trying to help out a brand new worship performer coming in, just to help them know what some common mistakes are.
Okay, let me take a swing at it and tell me if it's helpful, because there's a lot of parts in that I think could be addressed. One of the things I find for instrumental guys, I do get people who, like for keyboard players, were really good piano players, but they haven't played at a band in a whole lot. So one of the mistakes I find is they don't practice to a metronome. And a metronome is not so much something that restricts them so they play perfectly in time, but it's a training device for them to play and listen to something outside of themselves that they have to sync with. That helps solve the problem of not having played with other musicians if they haven't done it a bunch. So I find a lot of times, I just recently had two keyboard players who came in and they were really good piano players, but they played by themselves and hadn't played in a band. And I noticed that they can either overplay. So a lot of times they come in and they think they need to play all the bass notes or they need to play full two-handed stuff. And I'm like, no, I need you to play two notes with a pad. You know, so they just don't, their experience level doesn't, they don't know that it needs to be simple when you're playing with a full band. Or they don't play in good time where I'll give them a part. I'm like, electric players, the same thing. One of the audition pieces I give electric players is a song we do called Awaken Me. I think it's a Jesus Culture song that's in 12/8. And it's pretty technical. It's super busy. And I have them sit down and I put the metronome on. And if they can't play to it, I'm like, yeah, you just, you know, you're not, you got to spend time playing with the metronome so that you play really solid time. So I find that happens a lot. And that I think if they played with a metronome and played in a band, obviously, would be really good. The other thing I think that happens for instrumentalists is they listen to parts. I need you to come in and be able to change gears a little bit sometimes. The part that you played or the tone that you're playing it in, you know, sometimes we'll get in something. I'm like, wow, this front of house guy will go, that's a great song, but it's so busy. So I'll look to the electric player and said, okay, don't do distorted chords. Why don't you just do more volume swell stuff? And they'll look at me like, I don't know how to get that out of my guitar. So kind of not knowing the basic kind of tonal things that a guitar needs to be able to do within a general realm so that I can say, hey, everybody switch gears. Keyboards, as opposed to play something that's very busy and percussive, just play a pad. Electric player, I want you to play something clean tone that's more arpeggiated. So instrumentalists sometimes don't know those basic kind of cues, something arpeggiated, something textural, you know, those that helps kind of generally frame what they need to play. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That was great. I didn't really think about the keyboard one, but I've seen that now that you mentioned it. I know some great piano players who can just play amazing jazz stuff, but in a band context, they just don't have the experience. So it's totally different.
Yeah.
Similarly, what do you find for vocalists? What's a common mistake for a new vocalist?
Well, it depends. I mean, some of the basic ones you just hear is we do lots of vocal workshops with our singers. At least once or twice a year, I try to do, you know, bring in a studio singer, and they usually coach them and stuff. You know, a lot of times I find that they don't think about warming up, or they don't think about, warming up would be one. The other thing is they don't think about blend. You know, so you're seated with another singer, and you're used to singing by yourself, but you have to match vowels. You have to talk as a team about when you stop. You know, I tell them, I don't mean this as a egotistical thing, but I'm kind of the lead as a lead worship leader. So when I stop singing, if you're singing in parts with me, you need to stop. It seems funny to have harmony notes going after the lead vocal stopped. So they don't listen like that. They'll come in and they'll sing their part, and I'm like, yeah, you need to blend with me. If I stop, you need to stop. If I'm holding a vowel really open, you should hold it really open so we match. So a lot of times singers, you know, think their part is just to know the words, know the lyrics, know the harmony notes, and then that's it. I'm like, no, you got to blend too. Intonation's a part of it. How you match the other singers, and then as well as, are you singing in tune yourself? And then the final thing to me, I find singers, they worry about all the technical things, but in what I tell them, I'm like, the instrumentalists all have something in their hands or feet. So I expect from you guys with hands free to really help me be a visual worshiper by raising your hands or clap, you know, something that's more that we're signaling to the congregation. And a lot of times singers don't think about that. They're like, oh, I'm singing my part. I'm like, yeah, but this is a visual medium. We're not in a studio where it doesn't matter how you look. I'm trying to engage our congregation, and if you just kind of stare, that's not engaging. I had a lady come up and go, I just want to give one of your singers a hug. She looks like she had a bad day. And I'm like, look, I don't want this to be fake, but if our congregations feel like they got to pray for us while we're leading, that's not helpful. It just isn't helpful. So I'm like, how you look matters, and how you, again, I don't want anything plastic, and I don't want anything put on, but and honestly, I've had people at times, you know, hey, you know what, I had a really severe loss in my life. Or I'm like, yeah, dude, I don't want to put you in a place where you're uncomfortable, but maybe singing this weekend isn't the place you need to be. And all grace is, you know, given, we'll find somebody else to serve this weekend. And it's okay to need a week just to put life together and stuff. But I need you to be okay when you're standing in front of our people.
Good point. Have you ever had to let musicians go, quote unquote, from a worship team? And if so, do you have any suggestions for future worship leaders?
Yeah, I have. I mean, for lots of different reasons. There's just so many different kinds of reasons. I've had guys who I love, and you know, the one guy not too long ago was down. I was living with his girlfriend. I'm like, dude, this is a problem. I I care about your spiritual life and your connection with God way more than I do how you serve our church and being on the platform. So why don't you, I think it's incongruent to be a worship leader on the platform with us and kind of violating some basic principles of following God and purity. And so I said, I think once you step down, once that changes for you, let me know. And then I keep in contact with them. So those are hard. I mean, I hate those. I wish they folks would just want to be obedient, and but they're, you know, they run into their issues, and so I have to address it. I'm part of the guardian for our congregation too. It's like the people we put on platform, I gotta know that while not perfect, they're living at least, you know, with integrity, and there's some accountability there. So I feel like you have to address that. I do tell all of the people who come on with us that if I was to give advice to worship leaders, younger worship leaders, be honest with people. I think if they're on your team, they got to know that they're secure in that. So I tell them, you know, I'll audition you, and I have a very specific audition process I do with instrumentalists and vocalists and guitar players and drummers. There's certain things I want to hear from them and to assess their skills. And then I have them usually come on, put them on Planning Center, and then they usually serve once or twice for us, and then I give them very clear feedback. Man, everything you did on the audition, you did on the platform, and you sound, the parts were there, you sang in tune, you blended well, and then the other element is, you looked expressive, you looked engaged. I wanted to worship just by watching you, so you did great. And then I tell them, you're on our team, you know, now we're locked in, and until Jesus comes back or there's some moral failure, I don't know, whatever, you're on our team. And so, I create a bar that's basic for that. And the really great players, it's easier for them to get on, and then there's, you know, there may be players. But a lot of times, sometimes they'll say, here's what I tell people to say. The thing you have to do in any part of the process is you're looking for the next step. And if you think that way, then you're never really letting somebody go. You're just releasing them to their next thing. So I've had singers come in and I'm like, I love the tone of your voice. It's beautiful. But your next thing is to learn how to sing a harmony part. So let me give you this vocal coach and that's your next thing. Or I've had people come on the platform and they could do everything technically good, but I'm like, your next step, you need to be in front of an audience a lot. And this isn't the best place to learn to do that. So I said, what I would tell you, here's a choir. I would go sing in that choir or play in that band. You need some other experiences before the next step for you. And then I re-audition them. I say, anytime if I have singers who have a hard time with their tone, I'm like, if this is something God has put on your heart, don't think that you might not have to work for it. You might actually have to put some time and effort into getting competent so you can serve our people well. So when you're, if you've taken voice lessons for the next 6 months, come back and re-audition. I want you to be successful. And I need people on our worship team. So I would love to have you come back. But I do put the onus on them. Like, you may have to do some work. You may have to work with a metronome if you're a guitar player and learn how to play this thing in time. Everything else is good, but you may have to do some work. So I think when you have the attitude of what's the next thing, I think you don't feel like you're just shutting somebody down and just squelching them. You're saying, yeah, this is your next move. I see these potentials in you. I see your heart, but you're not quite ready for this. But I think if you did this, this would prepare you. And I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice. I like that. This is my last question. Second to last question. The next one, I'll let you choose one. I came up with this the other day. I was thinking about it. Tell me a time when you had to throw your plans out the window during a service and what happened.
I mean, that does happen with regularity where something we planned doesn't come together well. I mean, I can even think, though I don't remember exactly the circumstance, sometimes we'll look at what seemed good in the planning phase when we did the execution of it. The order of songs was wrong, or what I thought was a good handoff from the teacher to the musician, to the worship leader with the song, ended up being really a rough transition. And so we went back and said, okay, it's the right song and the right movement, but we've got to get into it more gently or more smoothly. So, we'll go, part of the thing is, what can I solve quickly by just a few little tweaks? What needs to totally get ditched? And I generally have a worship philosophy that says, I think there's a lot of different ways you can slay the dragon. I don't think there's always, this is the only way we can do this flow for the worship service. So we usually have little circle ups that I do with the lead pastors or the teaching pastors and the worship leaders or myself, and we go, okay, what's, and I also have a worship coordinator, volunteer, who I say is the last set of eyes on stuff. And so she may go, that was really awkward. What you said didn't make sense. And then you step back and go, okay, what can I say that would be smoother? Is there anything instrumentally we can do different? It doesn't bother me to change things. That's the other thing, is I'm not wigged out by, matter of fact, a regular part of our prayer is, God, do something that's not on the printed page, meaning here's all our plans, but we want nothing more than to see you show up and wreck our plans. That's the best. We just have to be adaptive. So I try to teach our players that though it's on the printed page, though it's prepared and planned, that's what we did, hopefully through the Spirit, but the Spirit in the moment, either we read it wrong or the Spirit in the moment is doing something different, and we want to come along with that. That's the highest goal. So I want to be adaptive. And sometimes you just can't always foresee. We just came from a weekend, so we were sketching out the weekend this weekend, and I'd charted it out a certain way with a certain flow. And I talked with we have, Saturday night and Sunday, and then we have a theater venue, and then we have another campus. So all the different worship leaders were like, man, it just doesn't feel like it flows really good. And so we sat in and we said, okay, and we came up with a great solution that seems to fit better. Now we'll see when we're actually in the moment, whether it came together good. And like last weekend, we did a piece where we did a thing on confession, and so we wanted to have this response piece where the people would write confessions, and they wrote it on this paper that's dissolvable. So we had these stations where we had water things, and people could crumple them up and put them in the water, and they would just dissolve away, which in theory was a great idea. The only thing was, when the people did it, it became this murky, ugly, looked like poopy water. It was not I'm like, so then we're like, oh man, now what are we going to do? And so we found a verbal way to kind of, I mean, we were into it then. And so we found a verbal way to kind of just laugh it off, but just realize, you know what? You can't see that anymore. God's confession is when you confess it, farther than the east is from the west. You can't see it. God's taken it up. He knows what it is, and he's thrown it out now. And so, you know, it didn't go perfectly like we planned. It didn't look as good as we thought, but we couldn't ignore it, that it was kind of an ugly little thing. So, you try your best and you plan. At the same time, you got to adapt when stuff changes and doesn't come out like you want. I did a thing one time where confession, where we had two fire pits, and we have to either side of the stage, we have exit doors. So we invited people to go out the exit doors, take their paper, put it in the fire pit and watch it burn, and then come back in. The thing I didn't plan on is the way our building is situated. There's a crosswind when you open both those doors, so the smoke was getting sucked in the room. And then we're like, okay, we've got to abort that. I can't have the sprinklers going off and ruining everything. So we had to change it. You know, so you're like, okay, that just was a cool moment, a cool thought, but now it was dangerous. You know, so we're like, okay, you got to let it go, man. It's just got to, you know, God's going to show up whether we do our little funny crafty things or not, you know.
That's great. All right, my last question is there anything you want to add? Anything, I don't know, words of wisdom, closing thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, those are great questions. I just think there's a lot of things in there. You know, am I speaking to worship leaders or is this,
yeah, it's a good question. The context matters a lot. You could focus on the worship team members, like the volunteers.
I'm just thinking there's just so many little things that, you know, you think about that would be helpful. Well, one thing I would say, and as a general thing to worship team members and participants on the worship team, is I think of, like, if you hold your index finger and your thumb together, they pinch. And the strongest pinch is when the pads touch each other, meaning they're both equal. They kind of come in congruence. And I think two elements you need as a worship team member is you need competency on your instrument, the ability to play technically all the things you need. But it does you no good, and it's not very powerful as a grasping tool, as a serving tool, if the other end is not the same way, meaning your spiritual nurturing of your spiritual life. So I think both of those have to be equal for a church musician. You can't be have a great heart for worship. You can't have a fervent, passion for God, have fruits of the Spirit in your life and be incompetent on your instrument. You have to have both of them. On the other side, conversely, you can't have just killer chops, huge experience playing with bands all over the world, and not have a heart for serving people and connecting with God in worship. Those two muscles have to be always fueled, always honed, to really serve a church well. And so I always tell our musicians, both of those I value. Both of, you don't have the luxury of doing one or the other. That's what makes a church musician so unique, I think. And that's what I think the cool thing is, that they look at it, everything they do, with not just, you know, it's not utilitarian. It's not just play your part. It's do it with craft and art and beauty. At the same time, think about who you're doing it for. When we begin our prayer, our worship rehearsals, I'm like, God, very quickly move us off the printed page of learning these notes and chords and get us to the place where there are conversations we're having with you. I mean, that's, both of those have to work together. And so, you know, to really call and challenge musicians to be guarding their heart and then at the same time be honing their craft.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Mark. I really appreciate this.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to this Sonic Nuance Electronics podcast. Please also see our blog at sonicnuance.com, which has more articles on performance, equipment, as well as interviews. SonicNuance.com has handmade rugged direct boxes with Phantom-powered chromatic tuners, as well as instrument and headphone extension cables. All products are designed, tested, and made in the USA for the ultimate in fidelity and durability. Sonic Nuance Electronics. Simply sound.